This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. I think we have probably all come to accept that any kind of communication conducted over the internet is probably being monitored by someone. And in a publication called The Intercept, reporter Ryan Gallagher catalogs the 8 hidden NSA spy hubs in U.S. cities, and it turns out one of them is in Seattle at the corner of 3rd and Seneca, which is not exactly a secret because I used to catch the bus there. In fact, it's a rapid ride bus stop. So, Ryan, we've contacted Ryan in Great Britain where he is based. You'll have to help me figure out what's new about this because, like I say, I think most of us suspect that our internet communications are being monitored. So what is it that you're revealing here exactly?
The short answer is we're showing the infrastructure. We're revealing particular buildings that people did not know before were involved in this. And it kind of highlights just how deeply embedded all of this actually is in terms of it being on U.S. territory. Because, of course, the NSA is supposed to be a foreign intelligence agency. So it is kind of showing the extent to which it is actually relies upon facilities on American soil within U.S. telecommunication networks.
Right. Well, these are AT&T switching facilities. In fact, the building in downtown Seattle has the AT&T logo on it. What you reveal in the story is that the NSA has been set up in these buildings for a long time, and they use these facilities to monitor, as you say, overseas internet conversations that are routed through the U.S. This has been going on for a long time, as I understand it. I mean, for a long time, I guess probably still, most internet communications ends up at one point or another crossing U.S. territory. So I can see where the NSA would want to take advantage of this. Is there evidence that they are abusing this to conduct domestic surveillance?
I mean, they've been working closely with AT&T for literally decades, since the 80s. And it's almost impossible, actually, for them to limit it. This is one of the things that we discussed in the story, is it's extremely difficult for them to limit it strictly to foreign. And there have been cases where they've been heavily rebuked by the judge in the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, which oversees some of what the NSA does, for doing unconstitutional surveillance. So they were sweeping up Americans, wholly domestic U.S.-only communication because they were having difficulty actually filtering it.
Weren't they supposed to have erased all that stuff, though?
Yeah, long story short, they're supposed to have stopped accessing it, but they continued until April last year, we'd recently discovered, and have now supposedly shut down an aspect of the program that was doing unconstitutional surveillance. But, you know, there are many aspects of this that we still don't know, and there are other programs that remain ongoing also that we lack insight into. So it's hard to give an answer one way or the other that's comprehensive on that.
Well, as I understand it, you make this distinction between collecting and accessing. The information gets collected, it gets stored, and it's basically used as a time machine. So if at some point in time they determine they've got a spy on the hook or whatever they're trying to follow, they can then go back and then access the data that was collected months or years ago to put the puzzle pieces together, correct?
Yeah, I mean, the idea in some cases would be they would retrospectively go through that. So when it's not like it would be impossible for them, in fact, to read everything they're collecting, because the quantities we're talking about here are literally billions of emails, for example.
So let me ask you this. Why shouldn't we be doing this, given that the Russians and I presume other countries are intent on targeting internet communications in this country, and given the fact that our economy is now completely and utterly dependent on the internet, shouldn't we be doing everything possible to keep tabs on those who might do us harm, even if it means that, for example, this conversation ends up in an NSA computer data bank somewhere?
Well, I mean, for me personally, I don't really want to make an argument for it or against it. I think for me, what I like to do, and what I feel my responsibility is to do as a reporter, is to reveal what I feel are important facts for people to then make informed judgments themselves about whether they think what's happening is right or wrong. And this story for me is part of that. We think that it's important that people be educated about the infrastructure in the US that has been established, the way that the government has sort of embedded itself within these important telecommunication facilities. And, you know, there are questions, like I said, there are legal cases, there are people who feel that certain that it's gone too far. There might be other people who say that it's acceptable, but I mean, I think it's, I would encourage people to read our story and to make up their own mind.
Yep, fair enough. Ryan Gallagher writes for The Intercept. The story is headlined, NSA's Hidden Spy Hubs in 8 U.S. Cities. And you'll see a picture of the building at 3rd and Seneca, where you may have caught the bus this morning. Ryan, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Dave.
Seattle's Morning News. If you notice that some fire aid calls seem to involve more firefighters than usual, it's no illusion. There's a reason for that, and Hannah Scott's been looking into it. We got a tip on this, Hannah. What was the observation?
They're doubling up on calls in certain areas of Pioneer Square. So I did some digging, talked to Seattle Fire, and here's what they told me. This is a temporary change in protocol for certain areas in Pioneer Square. Firefighters respond to dozens of medical calls a day. Many of them involve homeless for everything from a twisted ankle to an overdose. Now, normal protocol is to send an aid car. That's usually staffed with two people. But after an incident last month, that's no longer the case in certain parts of Pioneer Square. Now, in areas around 2nd Avenue Extension South, Washington, and 3rd Avenue South, all of these areas where there's a lot of homeless encampments, and the department will be sending at least two units. That can be an aid car, a medic unit, and at least one engine ladder truck. So that's 6 to 8 firefighters now for security purposes in these calls.
So what was the incident that prompted the change in policy?
This happened on May 18th of this year, and the new policy took effect 3 days later. So basically, firefighters were downtown on 2nd Avenue South Extension. They stopped for an assault call there. They were trying to help a patient, and a large group of people kind of surrounded them. So one firefighter was trying to deal with the patient. The other one was trying to do crowd control, and it just became dangerous. So they had to call the police and help disperse the crowd. And that now the fire department says they had already been kind of talking about maybe changing some protocols, but this incident really pushed it over the edge, and they changed.
And this is the area near the Union Gospel Mission?
It is, yeah. So this is, if you go downtown in the Pioneer Square area, you'll see, you know, you've got the Union Gospel Mission. There's some other homeless help available down in that area, and you see a lot of homeless people down in these areas. There's tents all over the streets
right
down there.
Well, we know the area well.
Yeah.
So was this crowd being threatening? I mean, if you've got a lot of people who are down there with nothing to do and there's some excitement, it's going to draw a crowd, right?
Well, yeah. And there's generally a crowd anyway. But what the department said was that it was interfering with the patient care. Now, the tip I got said that there was a possible assault on one of the firefighters. The department did not confirm that for me.
Uh-huh.
At any rate, it became dangerous, and they've changed this policy now. So again, so instead of two firefighters, you're getting 6 to 8 firefighters on every call in these specific areas down in Pioneer Square. So, and Seattle Police, they'll also kind of change. So even with that extra staffing of these firefighters, if it still looks like it could become unsafe, mm-hmm, or is unsafe, what they'll do now, what the Seattle firefighters are being told to do, is leave the area, call police to come down and deal with that. So that means they have to leave that patient there, right? They have to go and have that be deemed safe. So,
well, it's also going to cost 3 times as much, I assume, if you're sending 3 times as many people.
Well, and that was my assumption. What I was told yesterday is that the only real impact on their operating budget right now is the extra fuel to send that extra vehicle to each of these calls. Because they're on duty anyway. So what it's not clear, and a follow-up question I'm waiting to get an answer to, is what happens if you've got all those staff out there and they're needed for another call somewhere else?
Right.
Then what happens? So still doing a little bit of digging on this, but it's a pretty big deal. Right now, fire department only automatically sends police with their calls, fire unit calls, to areas around what we call the jungle in the East Duwamish Greenbelt area. And that's because there was a shooting there back in 2016 that caused some concern.
Well, the jungle isn't there anymore, I thought.
Yeah, but there's still pop-up encampments, and it's considered kind of a dangerous area. So that's the deal for right now. In this Pioneer Square area, they'll call for backup if they need it in these areas.
And so they've actually marked this out on a map. It's sort of a red zone?
They gave us blocks of where this will be happening. So it's going to be the 300 block of 2nd Avenue Extension South on both the east and west side, 400 block of that same street, 500 block of 3rd Avenue, and the 200 to 300 block of 3rd Avenue South, South Washington Street between 2nd Avenue South and 3rd Avenue South, and then all homeless encampments as well. All homeless encampments in the area. So
does this move the discussion forward at all now that even the fire department has to worry about its own safety when trying to help people?
Yeah.
That sounds like it's another indication that this is out of control.
I think you're absolutely right. And it's something I just finished kind of wrapping up with the Seattle Fire Department on this. And I want to talk to, you know, the mayor and the city council and see what kind of things, you know, this is obviously a big deal. Are they going to do anything to address this? Calls for firefighters have been changed over the last several years. And, you know, a lot of these, every time I go down in that area, if I'm down by the King County Courthouse for a story or city council, I always, almost always see fire crews down there helping someone, whether that's right. someone who is overdosed or someone who's having some sort, you know, someone who lives on the streets out there who's got some sort of medical issue. And it could be a mental health issue too, right? Firefighters are now, much of their job is not just, they kind of are like social service workers in a certain.
And this is just being revealed now.
This is just being revealed
now. It never came up for discussion in the city council or anything like that.
No. And again, I got a tip on this recently and started asking questions this week, and it was revealed to me yesterday.
All right. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Living in earthquake country and volcano country as we do, we were always being told to prepare for the big one. But there's the big one, and then there's the big one, by which we mean a global disease pandemic. Ed Young writes about this in The Atlantic. You've been writing about science for a long time. Tell me what makes you concerned that we could have an Ebola-like outbreak in the first world.
We have a long history of diseases that take us by surprise. And this is now the centennial of the 1918 flu pandemic, which was one of the greatest disasters in history. It killed between 50 and 100 million people around the world. New strains of flu are constantly evolving, which could have some of those same properties. And other diseases, both familiar and new, are cropping up all the time. So we are in a situation where the number of new outbreaks is increasing. We live in a globalized world where travel between countries is incredibly easy. And the prospects of a new pandemic are always on the horizon. And the world is continually underprepared for it. We panic when each new crisis hits, and then we lapse into forgetfulness and short-sightedness. So research dwindles, investment fall away, and we forget, and that leaves us newly vulnerable for each fresh crisis.
I thought, though, that the Centers for Disease Control is, that's why it exists. It is constantly tracking epidemics, and the moment that they detect an outbreak, and I think don't they crowdsource this now? Aren't there? Don't you use the web to track these things now so that you can nip it in the bud?
The CDC is one of the greatest public health agencies in the world. They are a force to be reckoned with. But when the most recent pandemic flu strain hit, it arrived in the U.S. months before anyone knew where it was going on. But when people's attentions were focused on bird flu in East Asia, this new strain of swine flu was developing in Mexico. And the same thing applies to us today. There are blind spots all around the world where our surveillance efforts aren't quite so good. So, you know, this is not to denigrate the CDC and the amazing work that they do, but there's still much, much more that could and should be done.
Now, you say they work around the world. Do we have to, are we expected to place disease detection agents in other countries to provide early warning? Is that how it works? Or do the other countries get a heads up?
Yeah, by far the best thing we can do is invest in the health systems of other countries, especially poorer ones. There has been an initiative called the Global Health Security Agenda, which has been trying to do that, but funding is running out. And President Trump's latest budget for 2019 threatens to cut the funding for that initiative by about 67%. That is widely seen in the public health world as a potentially disastrous move, which would cause a lot of good work that has already been done to be rolled back.
And that I see. That's what's fueling these warnings then, that President Trump has decided to cut a budget for catching disease outbreaks in other countries?
I mean, that's part of it. Partly these dangers have been, you know, talked about for some time, and there has been a lot of the same sorts of patterns. People panic, people put money and investments in and then roll them back when no immediate looming crisis is imminent. But the point of my piece is that this is exactly the time when we should be increasing our investments, when we should be, you know, it's now peacetime, we should be bolstering up our defenses for when the next threat emerges.
Now, in your own research, have you witnessed how other countries are attempting to deal with this?
So I went to the Democratic Republic of Congo, which is a country that has seen a lot of disease outbreaks, including 9 of Ebola. Ebola was, in fact, discovered in the Congo, and the country is currently going through its 9th Ebola outbreak. So it's actually very experienced at this. It's really interesting that many of the complaints that I heard from in the Congo were similar to complaints I heard in the U.S. about this theme of diminishing resources at times when no immediate crises were on the horizon. Themes about people being forgetful, about being short-sighted. And I think we think of preparedness in terms of like things like vaccines or protective suits. But really, this is an issue that boils down to psychology and politics. It boils down to our inability to look past the span of a political cycle and actually make investments for things that might be years or decades in the brewing, but could cause significant problems for us.
I know that the president was critical of President Obama for getting involved in the Ebola outbreak overseas, and I imagine that being that his thrust is put America first, he is probably going to be reluctant to send American money to it. I mean, he would expect that it's these other countries' responsibility to control their own disease outbreaks, right?
I think you could say that would be the case. I think that's a pretty fair prediction. When the Ebola outbreak in West Africa happened between 2014 and 2016, President Trump was incredibly critical of Barack Obama. He called him a psycho on Twitter for not banning flights from those affected areas, even though no direct flights actually existed. He was very critical of allowing American citizens who had become infected because they were out there helping to save lives from coming back into the country. That would be a disastrous policy. No kind of travel ban would actually stop the spread of diseases into American borders, but would actually discourage American health workers from traveling to these areas to help out, which would increase the chance that outbreaks would spread. America First just doesn't work for pandemic threats.
Ed Young is a staff writer for The Atlantic. He's on the Science Beat, and his last book is titled I Contain Multitudes, The Microbes Within Us, and A Grander View of Life. Ed, thanks very much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Time for our Sports Insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealer. And here she is, Daniel Neal's DH, Lydia Cruz, host of The Blitz, weekday mornings at 6 o'clock. Nelson Cruz, American League Player of the Week. How does that happen when the Mariners lose 5 out of 6 games in that week?
Yeah, not a great, as Nelson Cruz called it, a good week personally, not a great week for the team. And he is very much a team-focused person. But it happens because when you look at the two opponents that that the Mariners were facing, two of the best teams in baseball right now, the Red Sox and the Yankees, both 50-win teams. And he was able to hit .500 against both of those teams, which just adds to his impressive resume. So 7 RBI in one game alone last Friday, which, again, that was a bad result for the Mariners, but an impressive one for him.
You're a big fan of the Mariners. I see all your tweets about, you know, you're just ride or die with the Mariners. We've often talked to Danny about, okay, what does he see in this team? What's magic about this team this season? What about you? What do you think?
I think it is the playing for the next man at your side. I think it was Ryan Healy. I heard in an interview on 710 ESPN who had a great quote about, we view our success, we view another person's success as our own. which is just a very unique it's a response. He's one of the younger players on the team, too. But just to know that you, on the days when you are hungry, like you're sick or you're tired, that you are getting up and going out every single day for the guy next to you, I think creates a special
camaraderie.
Yes.
Had we not seen that in years past?
I think it is a testament to the culture that Scott Servais has created with the Mariners. It's a bit of a process. Like, baseball is not an immediate results game. And over the past 3 years, I think he has been very focused on building that type of culture.
Kind of sounds like a Pete Carroll type deal, right?
Absolutely.
Where he was able to create a real tight team on the Seahawks, and maybe the Mariners are starting to go that way too.
A little bit. Pete Carroll probably a little more focused on empowering individualism and individual players. I think Scott Servais still a board that wants people to be themselves and have their own personalities, but it is very much team.
And based on Felix's performance last night, it sounds like that everybody's fears at the beginning of the season that he was a has-been have dissipated, or are we still worried?
I think it wasn't by far his best results, and I talked to you guys a little bit yesterday about it's those moments where you're pitching at Camden Yards. There's not a lot of people in the park. It's one of the worst teams in baseball, the worst team in baseball, and he had kind of a rocky performance, at least in the span of the last five games that we've seen. It's only the second home run that he's given up all month. We saw it last night. And he was saved a couple of times by his teammates. It's that playing for your teammates. Mm-hmm. But Gene Segura made an incredible play in the sixth to save a run. Denard Span got him out of that inning. So I think it's more there's those moments to worry about for Felix when he's not under the biggest bright lights.
I've got an article in front of me that says, is tanking ruining the MLB? Can we explain tanking in 60 seconds?
Sure. Tanking is essentially a philosophy of building your team where you're willing to lose a bunch of games. The Astros did this probably most notably most recently. You're willing to lose a bunch of games to get higher draft picks to end up because the draft order is then dictated by where you ended up in the standings. So a lot of these people are getting higher up.
The Astros did this, mean during their last series?
No. Or? During the last couple of years before become really dominant. So they ended up with Carlos Correa.
They lost games in order to get a higher draft pick.
Yes. They ended up with Alex Bregman. They ended up with a lot of the players that are now their stars. So essentially, you're creating the lessening of the middle class is happening because you have teams that aren't interested in winning right now.
Do we used to call that throwing games?
I guess yes, that's a prettier description of
how
it.
How has this not been quashed by the higher powers in MLB? I mean, it sounds like a problem with the rules of the draft.
It is. They're trying to. There's been talk about it more recently, but then you see the results, which are the Houston Astros and to a certain extent the Yankees, although they have had a little bit more competitive success. They in the years when they were quote tanking, it's more that you see the results. The Astros won the World Series. So teams are having positive reinforcement from that. And they're saying, I can do it.
So torpedo your own ship so you can get a new ship.
Yes, get it. Exactly. Yeah.
Lydia Cruz from 710 ESPN. Decision was 5-4. The justices of the Supreme Court of the United States have now upheld the president's ban on travel, which includes a ban on six mostly Muslim nations. Let's go live to Washington, D.C. David Farenthold from The Washington Post. It was an all-caps tweet this morning from the president. Wow, third time, and he got it right. And this, I think it's fair to say that this is his approach. You keep trying stuff until you find out what it is that the courts will let you get away with.
That's right. So this court decision today, they basically said the argument from the opponents had been that Trump's tweets and his public statements had indicated that this was not sort of a ban based on security concerns or anything else, but they said it was rather Trump was motivated by a dislike of Muslims in general and a fear of Muslims in general. The Supreme Court's decision seems to be that no matter what you think President Trump was motivated by, as long as the law itself or the executive order itself was neutral as to religion, and as long as there are neutral reasons to have done it, that's enough.
Now, is this ban still in effect, or are we basically sanctifying something that no longer applies?
I think at this point, the most important sort of impact of this is sort of a decision about what the president's powers are going forward on immigration. Mm-hmm.
So basically, he now has carte blanche to ban any country's residents he wants to.
That seems to be the message here. I mean, you could imagine a situation where it would be illegal, where there would be some more manifest in the law religious discrimination. But if he does it the way he did it now, apparently he can do it. And the question is, what else? There's been a lot of other cases where things that Trump didn't write down in the actual executive order, write down in the law, have been used against, you know, he's been challenged for things that he said publicly, for things he said on Twitter, from people saying, look, you can tell Trump's had a sort of bigoted or prejudiced state of mind when he did this theoretically neutral thing. That's been an argument used a lot against a lot of Trump policies. That may be a harder argument to make now.
Right. Okay, now this whole civility thing. You're there in Washington D.C. What is the atmosphere? Is there a feeling now among Trump officials since what happened to Sarah Sanders and to Stephen Miller that it's no longer safe to dine in public?
I don't think that's true. I don't think most Trump administration officials wouldn't even be recognized if they went out in public. There have been a few cases, as you said, Sarah Sanders, Stephen Miller, Kirstjen Nielsen, the Homeland Security Secretary, have been sort of challenged, jeered, either in restaurants or Miller at his home, although he wasn't actually there last night. I mean, people that are saying, well, this is, you know, we've never had anything like this in American history, really are not great students of history. If you remember the 70s, you remember the 60s, there's been times even in pretty recent history, in the memory of a lot of people now, where American politics have been much less civil. That said, this is not a useful trend. It's not a good trend. I don't think for liberals who think that they're changing people's minds, I don't think they're changing anybody's minds by doing that.
Oh, that's pretty clear. Where do Schumer and Pelosi have dinner?
Who knows? I mean, it would be different if the District of Columbia was a very conservative place. Maybe they would feel that kind of social pressure. As it is, the only sort of time that around Washington, the only time that liberal politicians get heckled is by other liberals. You know, liberals seem to be the main ones who use that, and that's partly because there's so many of them here and they feel so emboldened.
Yeah. One more thing. Now, is there any indication that these heckling incidents have indeed been organized in some way, or was it just that they happened to be in the wrong neighborhood at the wrong time?
I think they were. Well, the Sanders thing where she was kicked out of the restaurant seems to have been a reaction by the staff at the restaurant. The Kirstjen Nielsen and Stephen Miller protests, those seem like they were organized. I don't know how long ahead of time they were organized, but there was the Democratic Socialists, this left-leaning sort of third party, has taken credit for them.
Oh, okay. So the Democratic Socialists. That's a little bit different than the Democratic Party.
Yes.
Okay. To your story today. Your headline, I have it here. The four times Trump signed tax returns for his foundation that contained incorrect information. That strikes me as a very carefully worded headline, David. You're not supposed to, I mean, doesn't it say, even on the president's tax returns, that you sign on penalty of perjury, right?
That's right. So these were tax returns for his charitable foundation, which it said right above where you sign. You're signing this under penalties of perjury, that you're attesting that everything in here is correct to the best of your knowledge. And four different times he signed that under penalty of perjury, and the return was wrong. There were wrong things in there. He had concealed things. He had omitted things.
Did he knowingly do this, though? Or did he know it? To the best of his knowledge, had he concealed things?
That's the rub here. Tax law is not like other. So it's a felony to lie on one of these forms knowingly, and that knowingly is the important word. Tax law is so complicated that you have to prove in a court, if you're going to charge somebody with tax law violations criminally, you have to prove that they knew the law and they violated it anyway. It's not like bank robbery or something. You don't have to prove people knew robbing banks was wrong.
Yeah.
And Trump's defense in this case has been ignorance. I just did not understand how charity law works. I didn't know. The old Dave Chappelle line, I didn't know you couldn't do that. And so that's been his argument so far, that he just understood so little of charity law and that his charity was so sort of loosely run that it violated these rules without anybody being aware.
Well, doesn't that make sense?
It depends on what you think of what Trump would have known, right? This is a guy who's bragged about knowing the tax system inside and out. We'll probably never get to see this tested in court. I don't think Trump will be criminally charged for this. But that would be the argument. He'd say, I don't know, you know, I had no idea what I was doing. Other people would say, you have access to the best lawyers, the best accountants. How could you possibly not have known?
Mm-hmm. Well, I look at all these stories and I ask myself, okay, what's in it for me, Dave Ross? Now, if they're not going to punish him for this, does this mean I can start deducting like $20 for every book I give away? Because I don't really know what they're worth. I mean, to the best of my knowledge, these are really great books that I've been giving away, and they're worth at least 20. Some of them, with the nice pictures, probably 100.
If you still got the dust jacket on them, I mean, go for 200.
All right.
You're right, though. I talked to a lot of lawyers for this story, and that's the question they raised. If the president is going to get away with telling falsehoods, signing false tax returns, how do you prosecute anybody else for that? How do you, if he's the person at the top of the food chain
exactly.
that's enforcing all this, how do you prosecute anybody else?
Exactly. So I guess what I'm saying is maybe a lot of us don't mind that he's not getting prosecuted for this. Because when we get the call.
What are you doing? Is there a Dave Ross Foundation?
There's not a Dave Ross Foundation, but, you know, I sometimes do get those little things in the mail from the IRS. You know, you forgot this, you forgot that. And I plead ignorance because usually that's true. But now I'm thinking if we've now institutionalized the plea of ignorance, the sky's the limit. And there are a lot of people, frankly, on a slightly more serious note, who would love to have some sort of organized tax protest against this administration. I'm not saying I'm one of them, but if this is the precedent, then you could have all sorts of shenanigans going on.
Well, what you're pointing out here is that the tax system is largely voluntary, right? The government depends on you for your personal tax returns, for your business tax returns, for your charity to tell the truth. I mean, so they come back and check people and audit them and punish people who get things wrong, but they don't check everybody. And so the system only works because people believe in the system. They believe that everybody else is following the rules that they are. And they believe that if you break the rules, there's a chance you'll get caught, and getting caught really hurts. And if the president's personal conduct is breaking down those feelings, that sort of sense that everybody else is following the rules, then that's a really big problem for our tax system.
David Farenthold, Washington Post. David, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Choke Points, brought to you by Online Trading Academy. I-5 drivers in Tacoma have been peppering Chris with questions about those giant foam chunks on the old Puyallup River Bridge. Were they dropped there by a truck? Why are they there? Chris, what is it?
Yeah, is it an Angry Birds set? Is it a
Angry
new thing
Birds?
For Mario Brothers?
Right.
You know, I got this text from the show during the show last week asking about this, saying, you know, these big white blocks appear to be styrofoam. There are dozens of them. What's the deal? And the listener pretty much is dead on. These are stacks of what appear to be foam blocks on the old northbound Puyallup River Bridge. You can see the pictures at mynorthwest.com. So I went to Kara Mitchell, who's the spokesperson for the Washington Department of Transportation working on the HOV project down there in Tacoma, and they are exactly what they appear to be. They are giant foam blocks. They're called geofoam, and they're used instead of fill dirt in supporting construction projects. In fact, I-5 drivers are on them right now.
They've been in place, and people are actually driving on them now when they take the 28th Street on-ramp to northbound I-5, and they are also being used on the new mainline I-5, northbound I-5 alignment.
Mitchell says they weigh a lot less than fill dirt, and they work really well in wet soil.
Because it's a riverbed, the soils are very soft and sandy and loamy. And instead of using traditional fill dirt, which weighs a lot more, this product, the geofoam, weighs much less.
And the weight issue was actually pretty important in that area because there's some very old utilities that run under that area, and if they were putting in fill over the top, they were worrying they might crush them.
We have some utilities, historic old utilities that are in this area, and we don't want those utilities to be displaced. And if you put anything super heavy on top of it, that increases that risk.
So a lot of the questions have been around, well, why are we seeing these now? What's the deal? Mitchell says they used to be stored out of sight. But, you know, that old northbound bridge makes a really good storage area for a bunch of equipment.
Earlier in this project, we had them stored down near the 28th Street ramp, and so they weren't as visible down there. But definitely when they're sitting up on the old bridge deck of the old northbound I-5 bridge, absolutely everybody can see them right now.
These are going to be used in the new southbound Puyallup River Bridge project, which is going to begin next year. By the way, that's the final phase of the HOV project.
The final phase?
Through that area to wrap up what will be more than 24 years of construction through Tacoma. They've also been used at other mega projects like the Alaskan Way Viaduct replacement, the 167-405 interchange in Renton, and they're also cheaper than traditional fill dirt, so there's a cost savings for these things as well.
Well, that's amazing. I wouldn't think it would be strong enough, but apparently it is because they're driving on it right now.
Yeah. And some of our listeners or some of our commenters at MyNorthwest.com have asked, well, what about corrosion? I mean, isn't foam susceptible to, you know, what's gasoline like that, or things like that?
That packing material, right?
It is, but it's all,
which
they're
never
also.
Never disappears.
Right. But they're also treated and covered with things to prevent any corrosive materials from getting on them in some locations. So it's well thought out and they're really well used. Go check out the pictures at MyNorthwest if you haven't been down the Tacoma area to see whether those giant
ice
cubes.
Do they want my old recycled packing foam?
They probably would, but I don't think it would be applicable. I don't think they would use. I don't think it's dense enough.
I didn't think you could bury that stuff in the ground. I thought that was some kind of violation.
Don't tell. Listen, they already did the environmental impact statement. We don't want to stop construction, Dave.